Well, good morning. We are going to be having a sermon coming from the patriarchs again. I've been preaching from, seems like the patriarchs for a long time. They lived a long time, and these sermons are lasting a long time. So we're going to have a, those of you who consider yourselves children, if you want to come forward over here on my right-hand side, and we will see if we can have a few thoughts. So, not very many children this morning, are there? So, we're going to be talking this morning about transitions. Does anybody know what, either of you know what the word transition means? Sounds like something would be inside your car and would help you shift gears, doesn't it? But that's a different word, actually. Yes, Grayson. It's a math problem. Well, not really. Like switching, that's right. So change. So transitions, times of transition are times of change. And I thought for a verse this morning, I would read from Isaiah 41, verse 13. And this is a verse, it's a promise that God gives all of us. He says, "For I hold you by your right hand, I, the Lord your God, and I say to you, don't be afraid, I am here to help you." So, have either of you moved houses? Mm-hmm. Victoria has. Do you remember moving from Indiana to Virginia, Victoria? A little bit. Well, so there are lots of different kinds of changes that we have in our house. So, we lived on top of a hill before, and we don't live on the hill anymore. We live in the woods, and some people are excited by changes. Do you all like changes? It depends on the change. Good changes you like and bad changes you don't like, right? How do you decide if it's a good change or a bad change? Yes, Grayson.
I would not like to move.
You would not like to move. Okay, well, there you have it. So I guess you all will stay in the same place. Well, we are glad for that. So one of the biggest changes I can think of in my life was when I became a medical student. You know what happened when I became a medical student? I went to medical school. I also got something very special. It was something white. What can you imagine what that would have been? A piece of snow, maybe? Can you think of anything else that they might have given me that was white when I got into medical school? Yes.
A shirt.
A shirt. No, I didn't get a white shirt. I had a white shirt. My mother washed my white shirt with red towels, and then it was a pink shirt. But that's a different story for another day. I didn't like that change. I got something else. I'm going to show you all. This is something very few people have actually seen me wear. This is something that is white. So what is it? Yes, Grayson. It's a doctor's coat. It's a white coat, okay? So this is not the kind of white coat that I got when I got into medical school. So when you get into medical school, you get a short white coat. That's so that people know that you're not real. And then when you become a resident doctor, then you get a longer one. And if you really are smart, then you get one that trails on the ground. But I never got one of those. So there are different things that happen when I became a medical student. So one of the things that happened is I became a third-year medical student, because the first 2 years are mostly you just studying out of books. But one of the things that happened was that I had to wake up early. Do you all like to wake up early? Yes, Grayson. Okay, so if there's something exciting happening, you'd be willing to wake up early for that, but otherwise not. Well, I was supposed to go to the hospital early and see patients before the doctor I was working with saw them, and so I would sometimes get up at 4 in the morning. That was early. I don't even get that up that early now. So another thing was I started wearing a white coat around. So I don't wear this anymore, though, because I don't really like wearing it. But back then, I felt pretty important when I would wear. And then I put lots of things in my pockets. What do I have in my pockets now? Yes, Grayson. Air, that's right. A magic ring. But otherwise, nothing. So I thought when I was a boy, my mother still is a doctor, but I thought that the most important thing when you're a doctor is that you had lots and lots of pens in your pocket. And she always had tons of pens. She always had 9 or 10 or maybe even more pens. So you put all these pens across your pocket, and then you use a different pen for each word, maybe. I don't know. And then I had all kinds of little books that I would keep in my pockets that would tell me all kinds of smart things, because I was back before they had smartphones. Yes, Grayson.
Mom said when you were baking and you put flour on, she did this when she was good.
Okay. Okay, it sounds like it. I had a little flashlight and I had little pharmacy books and different things like that. And it didn't really make give me some things I could look at if I didn't know the answer to something. And it also meant that if I'd fallen off a boat while I was wearing my coat, I would just sunk. But I never did that. So there are a lot of things that have happened in my work since that time. Change is hard. And God doesn't tell us that we won't ever have hard times, does he? But Jesus specifically told his followers that though they would have hard times, they should not be afraid because he had overcome the world. Remember that when you're going through a time of transition, a time of change, that it may not be easy, but God has promised to hold your right hand and help you, and that makes all the difference. So you all can go back to your seats. So I'm not going to wear this coat for the rest of the message, although y'all might watch me better if I had it on. So we're going to be jumping a bit. Genesis 35, which we are in, is the story of Simeon and Levi slaughtering the men of the town of Shechem. And you can imagine why I don't really want to study this. It's a pretty terrible account. And we find Jacob afterwards behaving pretty passively. Whole lot, and two of his sons taking matters into their own hands and killing all of the men of the town and then plundering the town. So Simeon and Levi killed all the men, and then the rest of the sons came in after they killed them and they took all their stuff. And this doesn't sound like a really good thing. And so Jacob said afterwards, in Genesis 34, verse 30, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few, gather themselves together against me and kill me, I shall be destroyed, my household and I." And Jacob didn't really seem to have a whole lot to say, did he? He didn't even say that what they did was wrong. He just said, because you all are acting badly. And that's kind of a weird thing, but he was more concerned about his own safety than about his son's behavior. So I wonder if you've ever gotten to the point where your family was not where they should have been. And maybe this is a bad example, but sometimes you're playing a game, like a game of chess, and you've made some bad moves, and the person you're playing is up on you, and you think, I am never going to win this game. I'm just going to resign and start over. So does anybody know if the best chess players lose chess games? Yes, Vincent. Maybe? No, they don't. They never get checkmated, do they? They always resign before they get checkmated. That's what you do, because you don't want to get checkmated. You'd rather just resign if you see that you're going to lose. But life isn't that way. It's not like you can just make a mistake or two and then you just back and go back to where everything was good and then start from there. And I was thinking of a poem. This is not a Christian poem, but it's a very famous poem that Robert Frost wrote. It's about two roads. You all know that. Said, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I was I could not travel both. And be one traveler, long I stood and stared down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps a better claim, for it was great and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same." And he goes on and he talks about these two paths and trying to make a decision between those two paths. And he says, eventually he came to the conclusion he to take the one that didn't look like it had been traveled quite as much. And he called it, this poem, The Path Not Taken. And if you notice, when he talks about it, he's not talking take, he's talking about the path that he did not take. And he finishes up saying, and both that morning equally lay, and leaves no step it trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubt it come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And we don't really know why Robert Frost. Maybe it was about his decision to become a writer. Maybe it was something else in his life. But what he is saying is he knows that sometime down the road, he is going to think about this decision that he made and second guess it. And he's going to say, you know, I kind of wish I'd taken that other road. And I think a lot of us come to a place in life where we wonder, the wrong path. 10 years from now, if you go back and you try to change, you go back to school and do something different than what you're doing right now, it won't be the same because you've been in the interim. But I think one of the joys of serving God is that he does not hold our mistakes against us. Psalm 103, verse 12 says, as far as the east is from the west, so far he has removed our transgressions. I suppose we do need to realize that even though God forgives, we do have consequences of our decisions. But on the other hand, it's a blessing that God's mercies are new every morning, isn't it? Genesis 35, I'm going to read this chapter. I'm calling this a chapter of transitions. So there's all kinds of little things that happen in this chapter. And so I have way too many thoughts, but we'll try to go through them as best we can at the end. So Genesis 35. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon them around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, which that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there, and called Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree. So the name of it was called Bachuth. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came up from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name. Also, God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give descendants after you. I give this land. Then God went up from him in the place where he talked to him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel birthed, and she was had hard labor. Now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, do not fear, you will have this son also. And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she Benoni. But his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave. Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard about it. Now, 12, the sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, where Isaac had dwelt. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, so Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So I don't know when you read a chapter like this. When I was sitting down to prepare a sermon from this, I thought, what is this? It's just a bunch of stuff. And it makes it hard to prepare a sermon. But we're going to try to go through these things, draw a few different lessons out. But I think the important thing that we need to dwell on here is that this chapter is a chapter of transition. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the author of Genesis sticks in certain times when he will let you know things are moving on. So he'll tell about, put in a list of genealogies, and it will let you know whatever happened before, we're moving on to a new set of characters. And he didn't have different chapters. I guess probably they didn't in scrolls, but this is a way of saying, look, our focus is changing. So I'm not sure exactly what God intended for Jacob to do when he returned to land. I'm guessing he wanted him to go to Bethel right away and not to go to Shechem. But Jacob was afraid. He was afraid of Esau and Bethel was a little too close to Mount Seir where Esau was living, and so he decided to go to Shechem. And then, of course, bad things happened at Shechem. Jacob decided, okay, well, I'll go to Bethel. And God wanted him to go there, so that worked out. So before they went there, Jacob told his family to get ready, and this involved three different things. So y'all notice these. First of all, themselves. And we don't know exactly what this purification looked like, but water was used in the Old Testament for purification. They did not have baptisms in the Old Testament, did they? But they did purify things with water. If something in your house would put water on it, and it was supposed to cleanse it. Before you went to the temple or tabernacle, you would bathe, and that would purify you externally, and was something that had happened in your heart. Second thing was that they were need to change their clothes. And we know that in the Old Testament, at least, people made a big deal about what kinds of clothes they wore to the tabernacle. I know a lot of people these days, most important thing is that you just feel comfortable in church, and maybe that is the most important thing, but I do think there's something to be said for wearing nice clothes to church, so I'll just say that. And the final thing is that they were put away their false gods. This is real. So Jacob hadn't known that Rachel had stolen her family's idols, but he knew that some people in his company had idols. They called them teraphim, and he wanted to put them away. He wanted all that stuff gone. And nobody really knows why he buried these idols instead of having a bonfire and burning them. Maybe they were metal and so they wouldn't have burned too well. But all the commentaries Jacob was secretive so that the people weren't going to get these idols back. He didn't tell people where he buried them. And nobody knows about the earrings either. So I can't tell you why the earrings were, why they were supposed to get rid of their earrings. There must have been some connection to them, but you know, it's just difficult to say. Because the Jewish people did wear earrings, even though we don't. So we're going to think a little bit more about the return to Bethel later, but I do think it's important, God who told them to go to Bethel. So all spaces on earth are filled with God, aren't they? You know, Psalm 139 says that, doesn't it? There's no place on earth that we can go that we can escape from God. God, he was also at Mount Seir and he was at Bethel too. But when we talk about sacred spaces, we are talking about places where we as humans focus ourselves better on our creation. And these are important. So I've heard some people say that they feel like they can worship God better when they're hiking or when they're golfing or fishing. And maybe that's true, but maybe that just says something about them. It doesn't say about God. And it's not accurate to say that we worship God equally in all places. So when I was thinking about what sort of places are conducive to worship, so I don't know what Bethel was like at all. Bethel, probably the big thing was just the association in Jacob's mind, his first encounter with God. God had appeared to him, and he saw this ladder or stair going up into heaven, and he said, this is the house of God. That's what Bethel means, right? So places that are conducive to worship, first of all, identify with God. So when we think about the New Testament, we think about a church. When we think about the Old Testament, we think about the tabernacle or a temple. Places that are dedicated to serving God. That is, they are not purposes. So doctors, sometimes people have trouble sleeping at night. And one of the things that we tell people is don't use your bed for anything other than sleep. So if you're somebody who takes your homework into your room and does all sorts of things, reads books and all kinds of trouble, then shutting off your mind, try doing those kinds of things in a different room. And then when you lie down, maybe you will think more about sleep than you do right now. There are places that we associate with the worship and that are focused only on serving God. They should be places that have minimal distractions, and they should have other people present who are also focused on serving God. And as I think about our new sanctuary, I will be that sort of a place. I know that's what we're working for. So the chapter next says that the fear of God was on the people of the land. So Jacob expressed anxiety at the end of chapter 34 about whether the people in the land attacked them because of Simeon and Levi's slaughter of the men of Shechem. Maybe it seems like a silly thing. God had protected Jacob so many times before. Surely God would continue to bless him. But I think human nature is such that we tend to look at today's problems as bigger than yesterday's problems. I don't know what you're facing this morning, but it feels really big. And the stuff that you last year or 2 years ago or 3 years ago is not top of mind. And so we think of it as though, well, that was then and that wasn't as big a deal. These problems that I'm facing are huge. But maybe it's how when you are standing close to a tree at the foot of a big mountain, the tree looks bigger than the mountain. It's because we're close. In the same way, Jacob did not remember clearly how scared he was when Laban was chasing them, how scared he was of Esau coming to meet him, and all the other times God had protected him. And the passage clearly says that God was protecting Jacob. It wasn't because Jacob had trained up a little military force or had, you know, put guards around his camps, but because the people are God. Next, we come to the death of Deborah. So I don't know if you all find this mention of the death of Deborah interesting or strange. I thought it was kind of strange. Why is she even mentioned here? We never heard about her before, have we? Well, we sort of did. There's a place in Genesis 24:59 that says that Laban sent Rebecca when she left Haran. And so a lot of people assume this is the same woman. So if that was, she was pretty old. She was probably 100 years old. And nobody really even knows how she ended up becoming attached to Jacob's company. She didn't journey with him from Palestine to Haran. And so I don't know much about her. We don't know anything about her, but she is listed as somebody who does. And it was a big deal to the people in their company. And I think it's important for us to remember that lots of people in the Bible were not great heroes of the faith. Yes, there are people like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but there were just who helped make things run. And those people are important too. I think of Andrew and Peter. Who was more important? Peter was more important. He was the one who always talked up, and he said, you know, let's do this, and the people did it. Because he's the one who stood up and preached, so he must have been most important, but we remember that Andrew was the one who met Jesus first. And Andrew went to his brother and said, we have found the Messiah, the anointed one. And that's the way it is. Sometimes common people make a difference. So our tendency in the hospital setting is to view certain people as more important than others. So, you know, if you would take a poll of the people in the hospital, the surgeons and the neurosurgeons, maybe cardiothoracic surgeons, they would rank themselves pretty high in the list of importance in the hospital. They do functions that nobody else could do. And it's important. But the reality is it takes a team of people to care for somebody after surgery, to get them healthy enough to prevent infection and get them back home safely. And in the same way, important. And so when she died, they spent time and buried her, and they mourned her, and they called the tree where she was buried Alon Bakuth, the tree of weepings. And it's a that not all of us can be a Jacob or a Peter, but we can all be a Deborah or an Andrew. And we shouldn't be ashamed of that fact. So God appears to Jacob again. Basically, he reaffirms the promises that had been given earlier. There's nothing new here. God is telling Jacob, I'm the same God that I was, and that's okay, because I have purposed in my heart that I will take care of you, and I am going to fulfill a promise I made all the way back in the Garden of Eden to send someone who will defeat Satan and sin and death. And so, when you read the Bible and you think about it, you are meeting the same God that your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather met. And that is a blessing. And in response to this, Jacob. So, two more deaths then. First, there was the death of Rachel, and then of Isaac. So if you've been paying attention, this chapter has three deaths in it. Deborah, Rachel, and Isaac. Deborah and Isaac were both expected deaths. They were old. Isaac was 180 years old. Deborah was certainly well over 100 years old. But on the other hand, Rachel's death was unexpected. She was probably in her 30s, maybe around 40. And she had had a child already, and her sister had seven children. All okay. And this time was different. Back in October, we visited Cades Cove, and we walked through a little Methodist church. They've got a cemetery there. And one in the cemetery caught my eye, and it had the names of three children from one family who were buried there. Two of them had just a single date on them. One of them had about 3 weeks span. There were a number of women who the span of their life was not very long by modern standards. And we realize how blessed we are today. Childbirth 150, 200 years ago was a dangerous thing. I tried to figure out how many women died in childbirth prior to the modern era, and it seemed 2% of births ended up in the death of the mother, not in the death of the child. Probably more children died during childbirth, but 2% of mothers died in childbirth. And even last year, there were approximately 330 women who died while giving birth. So here you find that Jacob and his family were traveling near Ephrath. What is Ephrath? Does anybody know? Bethlehem, that's right. So Rachel went into labor, and it was a hard labor. All labors are hard, but this was a time before anesthesia. You can imagine the desert heat in wondering when her suffering would end. And here we have the midwife telling her, as she is dying, you have borne a son. Everything is okay. And Rachel has nothing to say except, name him Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow. And Jacob didn't. He changed that name. And we can understand that. He named him Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. But in this story, I flash back to the early days of Jacob and Rachel's marriage. And if you remember, Leah was having all the children, and Rachel came to Jacob. She had had no children. And she said, give me children or I die. And here we realize that she could have said, if you give me children, I will die. So often the things that we desire most carry with them a burden, no concept of. Think about James and John asking Jesus if they could be on his left hand and his right hand when he came into his kingdom. And he's saying, you have no idea what you are asking. When I come into my kingdom, I am going to be outstretched on a cross. And you don't want to be on my left hand and my right hand. And I think, too, of the verse in the New Testament. There's a quotation from Jeremiah after Herod had killed the innocent children. In this very site of Bethlehem, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and grief. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And you can understand why the prophet would use this picture of Rachel near Bethlehem, crying as her child is born. Finally, we come to Isaac's death. So this is the final one of the three deaths, and he was the oldest one, probably. So this is the last time that Jacob and Esau are mentioned together. I think that Jacob and Esau didn't have much of a relationship. And I suppose it's not unusual for families to come together with death, even if they don't get along during life. It's not a good thing, but it's a real thing. And Isaac's death comes out of order. So I'll do the calculations. I have looked at this. He was around 100 years old when Jacob stole Esau's blessing. Then Jacob spent 20 years in Haran, and 60 years after that, Isaac died. And so if we figure out the chronology, we will figure out that Jacob moved to Egypt around 10 years after Isaac's death. So I do think it's really important that these three deaths are grouped together. And the cast of characters is changing. There's different people going to be on the scene, and pay attention to that. No longer is Jacob the important one. Jacob's sons are going to be the important ones. And it's mentioned that there's different groups of Jacob's sons. So there's Rachel's children, who were the most valuable, Leah's children, who were slightly less valuable, and then the children of the maidservants, who were least valuable in Jacob's eyes. That was a pretty toxic way of looking at it. So parenting is hard even when you try to do a good job. Jacob wasn't really trying. He was himself in these relationships, and it was pretty toxic. So let's go to some applications. These are just things that I think we can gather from this passage. There's probably lots of other things. So sometimes we need to get back to basics. So that's what the trip back to Bethel is about. Things were not on track, and they needed to get back to some place. And Ephesians 4, 1 through 3, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. It's a basic thing. Come together with people who love Jesus and be... And yes, you can't go back and redo decisions that weren't great, but you can refocus yourself on things that are really important. So I'm going to tell you that there are a couple of aspects of this, and these are things that we see in Jacob going back to Bethel. So first of all, you need to eliminate the things that are not appropriate for your life, that are keeping you from pursuing Jesus. So what were those things? Well, first of all, purification. See that in James 4, verse 8. Eliminating false gods and idolatry. Second, you need with the worship of God. So maybe it's simply getting out more time out of the times that you already spend with God, figuring out a way that you can connect better with God when you're with God's people in your own devotions. 95, 6, and 7, O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. I don't think we worship enough, and I don't think we get as much worship as we should. Second thing is that preparation for worship is important. So, as I've already said, location is important. It is good in a place that's dedicated to the worship of God with people who are also trying to worship God. If you're going on a long hike, experts will tell you that you should keep your backpack at no more than 20% of your body weight. For some of that, that means that you have to be extremely careful about the things you carry with you. You don't put everything in your backpack. You're going to choose the lightest pack possible, and you're going to keep the weight down. And I'm afraid that when we come to church, we don't remember. And we fill our backpack with everything from the week, and we sit here, and we are tired, and our minds are going every which way. And God has trouble speaking to us. I'm not going to ask for a raise of you raise your hand inside, okay? How many of you all read the Bible on your cell phone? Okay, that's fine, okay? I saw a lot of hands go up there. I'm just kidding. But I want you to ask yourself, how well do you focus on Scripture when there's other things on your phone that you could be focused on? And I find that I don't read the Bible very well on my phone because there's other things that I could be checking on my phone. And I don't have enough willpower to do what I should be doing, and so I get less out of it. So does that mean you can't read your Bible on your cell phone? You should read, okay? And so if it's on your cell phone and that's the only Bible you've got, that's fine. But I just want to encourage you, make sure that you are well focused. Do not be afraid to mention God's promises to him. So God reappeared to Jacob and he gave him promises that were old promises, but they had not changed. And God is faithful. Be willing to be a Deborah. So I hope that we are Deborahs can flourish. When we think about a church fundraiser, it takes a lot of different roles for it to come off, and it takes people cleaning up setting up beforehand, cleaning up afterward, and none of these jobs feel like you're doing it, but they are all a big deal, and it all is important. So I'd like to spend just a little time, we don't have a whole lot of time here, do we, thinking about dealing with times of transition. I mentioned before, but this chapter in Genesis is a chapter that indicates transition. So the book of Genesis has a way of indicating that time is moving on. The focus of the book is going to be different, and often is through a genealogy. It says, these people had these children, and then it'll stop at a certain point, and then you realize that's the next person that we're going to focus on. And when we think about our own lives, we have times when we go through transitions too. Sometimes these times are marked from one educational point to another. We graduate from high school and go on to college or go to work at a job. We move from working for someone else to starting our own business. Sometimes these are marked by changes in location or marital status. And I was thinking about the move that I had when I moved from Indiana to Virginia. It's not quite 8 years ago now. And I was really burned out in Indiana. We didn't live close to our church, and I felt like it was to move. And after we moved, I wondered more than once if it had been the right decision. It wasn't about church stuff, so y'all don't need to worry about that. All my patients, and I had been seeing the same patients for 17 years in Indiana, and I don't even know that they liked me, that they were used to me, and that was something. And so if I'd make a joke, they would sometimes laugh, occasionally. And when I moved to Brookneal, a lot of my patients wanted to know if I was from New Jersey. I'm not sure why they asked about that, but I wasn't, which I think that was a small plus in my favor. They also wanted to make to be staying, which a lot of them seemed to think I was not going to be staying. And some of you enjoy change, and some of you don't like change at all. I don't like change very much, and I would rather stay and enjoy just because it's too hard to change. I ate Raisin Bran for breakfast nearly every morning for 4 years in medical school because it was easy and I didn't have to think about it and I just got it and I got breakfast. So maybe you want some kind of a rule of thumb to use when you're dealing with change. A lot of you have experienced deaths in your family recently, or you can see that possibility in not hard transitions that are involved with saying goodbye. We're planning to move to a new sanctuary. And this is probably exciting for us, and yet somebody told me that it's a little hard to say goodbye to the old sanctuary because there's so many memories that are, and some of us are probably more sentimental than others. I can't tell you exactly how you know what God's will is when you're going through a time of change, but I do have a few to encourage you along the way. Some Bible verses that have helped me. So Jeremiah 29, verse 14 is a well-known verse. It says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future hope." And I think a lot of people take this verse out of context. This verse is not written to the people of Judah. This was written in a letter to captives in Babylon. They were waiting for God to bring them back home. They didn't like this change. This transition from Judah to Babylon was terrible. And there were false prophets who were saying, any day now, Babylon will be defeated, go home, and God is good. And they said, yes, God is good. And Jeremiah told them, build houses, settle down, get married, because you are staying there for 70 years. Good at all. And in the middle of this, he says, but God cares about you and has a hope for you and has a future for you. And when we're going through times of transitions, I think few things we need to remind ourselves of. First of all, is that God will use all things for our good if we love him. This is Romans 8, verse 28. This does not say that all circumstances are good. It just says that God is amazing, and that he can work something good in our hearts and lives through bad things. Second thing is that God does not change. So maybe this doesn't sound great. It's not saying that God is a stubborn old man who is set in his ways. He does not need to change in order to deal with the chaos that's around us. It's Malachi verse 3:6. And the third thing is that God is with us. I read that verse from Isaiah 41 to the children. The message of Emmanuel. God will never leave us or forsake us. Hebrews 13, verse 5. So we're still in the first month of the year 2024. No idea what the rest of the year will hold. Many things in 2025 will be different, and many things will be exactly the same. Even if the situations you face are different, you are not the same person you were before. I was thinking about the people that we said goodbye to in 2024. On a national stage, there were people like Jimmy Carter and Pete Rose and Willie Mays. Those last two were baseball players, if you don't know. Here locally, we know Charles Anderson's smiling face and their other family members that you all have said goodbye to. I'm not a hellfire and brimstone preacher, but it seems like there were a lot of things up. And it's really important that every so often we sit down and realize we are not going to live forever, that we're not going to be here forever, at least not in these bodies. Hebrews 7 and 28 says, and as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this, the judgment. So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time for sin, for salvation. We're going to meet Jesus. It may be that we meet him through death, maybe that we meet him in the air. But this morning, as we think about transitions, times of change, you should ask yourself a couple questions. First of all, how well have you done at passing on your faith to the generation that's coming behind you? Some of you are in the process of doing that right now, struggling to know exactly how to do that. All of us have an opportunity to share our faith and encourage others and lead people who are going to come when we are no longer on the scene. Second, I want you to ask yourself if you are ready to meet Jesus. Judgment is coming. But the passage in Hebrew says, Jesus is coming, but we do not need to fear him if we've accepted his sacrifice. Jesus told a lot of parables which emphasize two things. We don't know the time or the season of his coming, but we are you ready?